So let's get started with Poon's visit to North Korea. Right now, in the mainstream media in the West, they're talking about that she's not happy with this visit of Poon to North Korea. How did you find it, in your opinion? How important was this visit and how China sees this visit, Poon?
Well, first off, Nima, thank you so much for having me on your show. I love your show. You're a wonderful host. You do a great job, and I'm humbled and honored to be here tonight.
My pleasure.
North Korea and Russia, I th th you know the Western press is always trying to separate Russia and China. They'll use any pretext that they can to try to show that China and Russia are at odds with each other, that Xi and Putin are not talking, that there's this problem and there's that problem. They have a dream of another sign of a second Sino-Soviet split, which is like what happened in 1960, which was earth-shaking, and unfortunately very tragic for world history. Of course, Xi is very happy that any help that North Korea can get, China is extremely happy to have that kind of cooperation. And it fuses the what I call the Asian Quad. I call it the Asian Quad together, and the Asian Quad being China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. And as long as those four countries, Iran, Russia, North Korea, and China, stick together, there is nothing that the West can do to foil the plans of the Asian project. So that's just, and it's earth-shaking. It is one of the most important events to have happened in the 21st century already, because they signed a mutual defense treaty. Now, what that means is that if someone attacks North Korea, Russia will be obligated to come to North Korea's aid, and North Korea is obligated to go to Russia's aid. And what a lot of people don't know is that since 1961, China and North Korea have had a mutual defense treaty that Zhou Enlai signed with Kim Il-sung, back in 1961. It was renewed in 2021. So now you have North Korea and China and Russia involved in mutual defense treaties. So this is actually earth-shaking. What happened with Putin going to North Korea and working with Kim, with the leader, North Korean leader. It's earth-shaking, Nima. It really is. It's that important.
Yeah. And how do you see right now, coming to the conflict in Ukraine, how do you see the conflict right now at this current phase? What the Biden administration is doing, what the Ukrainians are doing? They were attacking Sevastopol, attacking on civilians. How do you see the current phase of the conflict in Ukraine?
I think, like a lot of us, are frustrated. President Putin is a very patient, very sagacious leader. He's a visionary leader. He is not going to rush into any decisions quickly. Sevastopol is, every time something like this happens, they kill a bunch of people inside Russia, or they blow up this, they blow up that in Russia, and everybody's, oh, Russia's going to, now they're going to come out swinging, and they're going to really, roll over Ukraine and go all the way to Lviv, and they're going to take over Kiev. But Putin, sees that. I think he sees the advantage of the slow pace, where they're just taking village by village. They're literally sucking the blood. They're just draining the blood out of Ukraine. Ukraine is now, capturing, and women are being, are being, gang whaled into the army. They're now dropping the age down. It's slowly dropping down to 18. The average age of a Ukrainian soldier is 43. I mean, they are literally depleting their people. And I think President Putin, in spite of the fact that from what I understand, even Russians are getting impatient, and that they want a more muscular, aggressive response. But I think he sees the, I think he's so visionary, and he's thinking about not, next week or next month. He's thinking about next year and the year after. I think he sees the advantage of just continuing to just suck Ukraine dry, and it's also sucking NATO dry. It's causing disharmony with Hungary and Serbia, standing against Brussels and Washington. I look at the map on what's the website? South, I can't remember the Russian site. And I look at the map, two or three times a week, and it just seems like it's not changing. It just seems like, why aren't they going to Odessa? Why aren't they going to Kherson? Why aren't they going to, why aren't they going to, Kiev? Why don't they come south, and go into Kiev? That's the way I'm thinking, and I think that's the way a lot of people are thinking. But I think Putin is, and his, and his, he's not a dictator. I mean, he has a military council, a military tribunal, and he has an entire, hierarchy of people that are working with him on this. And I think they're taking the long view. They're just going to suck Ukraine dry. If a few missiles get in, I think fewer will get in. That after what happened, they keep, trying to upgrade their air defense system. And I think I keep hearing there's going to be a big, offensive this summer, but I don't think it's going to happen. I just think they're just going to literally wear Ukraine down to nothing and wear NATO out, and deplete their resources as well. So, I personally believe that the only solution for Russia to have peace and happiness against Western Empire is they can't stop at the Dnieper River. They can't stop in Kiev. They cannot even stop in Lviv, in Western Ukraine. They're going to have to go all the way to NATO's borders with Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Moldova, which is, of course, now blocked off by Transnistria. But they're going to have to go all the way to NATO's borders, put in, several divisions of tanks along the border to protect it. Because if there is any area that is designated as Ukraine, they're just going to keep flying in, railroading in, flying in and railroading in NATO soldiers, NATO armaments, NATO guns, NATO everything. So there, I predict that in 5 years, Ukraine will become the what we know as Ukraine today, will be a part of the will return to the motherland where it was for centuries, and where it should be. And I can't see any other solution for Russia to have peace. To have peace and harmony on its borders.
Yeah. When you look at the Biden administration right now, do you think the way that you're describing the conflict right now, the way you're describing the Russian strategy in this conflict, do you think the Biden administration is understanding any of these things that you're talking about?
Well, Nima, you have to understand that in the West, military victory is not necessarily the goal. The military industrial complex wants long, indeterminable wars that drag out, for decades. Look at what's going on in Iraq. Look what's going on in Afghanistan. Look what's going on in Syria. They don't want, they don't really necessarily want victory. They just they they're they the military industrial complex in the West is private. Russia and China and North Korea. And I'm sure, Iran, a lot of it, you would know more than I would, but I'm sure that there's a strong state element in the defense industry. I know in China it's 90, 95% state-owned. North Korea is 100% state-owned, and I suspect that Russia is at least majority state-owned. But in the West, it's all about profits. It's all about generals getting jobs at McDonnell Douglas, getting jobs at Boeing, getting jobs at Lockheed Martin when they retire, consulting jobs. It's a business. The military industrial war in the West is all about business. It's all about making money. So that's the problem. You can be very cynical and say, for the West, for NATO, the war in Ukraine is going really, really well because they're opening up a $500 million artillery shell factory in Texas, and they're building all these arms, and Germany just is opening up a new armaments factory. This is for Iran and for Russia and for the DPRK and China, the military is to protect their borders and to protect their people. That's not necessarily the case in the West. It's all about making money. And so I don't think they really care. I mean, they're just going to keep printing, and this is the big problem. As long as they can keep photocopying trillions and trillions of euros and trillions of dollars, just photocopying, and until that house of cards comes down, until people finally say, okay, we know that the Bank of the Central Bank of Europe and the Central Bank and the Federal Reserve, they're never going to pay this money back. We know it's never going to be paid back. It, right now, it's just like a poker game. We're just, everybody just looking at each other, and everybody knows that's never going to be paid back. As long as they can keep printing trillions of dollars, and funneling all that money into Ukraine and Palestine, and circulating, and which is it's basically like a money laundering. It's like a money laundering machine, and the money goes back to Berlin, the money goes back to Paris, the money goes back to London, the money goes back to Washington, the military, campaign donations, for the military donating campaign money to the to Congress and to the Democrats and to the Republicans. It's big business. It's a trillion dollar business. And so I would say that from the Western standpoint, they don't care. They're just going to keep doing what they're doing. And we know there's NATO. We know there's NATO troops there. We know here in France. I live in France. We know that there's French soldiers in Ukraine right now. We know there are British soldiers. NATO's already there. Polish soldiers are already there. So the war is on. I mean, this is a war between NATO and Russia, and so we've got this who's going to last longer? Is Putin taking village by village, working their way towards Kiev and Kherson and Odessa? Will they go beyond the Dnieper River, into Western Ukraine? But for NATO, it's just a gigantic profit machine.
Yeah, the point you brought up is so important, so crucial in my opinion, that you believe that the military industrial complex wants this war going on and on. And we know that recently Stoltenberg was talking about decades of conflict in Ukraine. This is a sign. He's talking about something in the mind of NATO countries right now. We know in Iraq and Afghanistan, the same attitude. But here comes the question. Right now, they're not dealing with Iraqis. They're not dealing with Afghanis. They're dealing with Russia. Russia is a superpower. In your opinion, would Putin let this war continue?
But Nima, look what happened since the sanctions, since February 2022, when the Russians started their special military operation to protect the Donbass. Russia has gone from it now has a bigger economy than Germany. It's now like the fourth or fifth biggest economy in the world. The ruble's stable. They have almost no foreign debt. They've ditched the dollar. Everybody else. I mean, even Europe is buying Russian energy. They're just buying it, through third parties. Russia has just gone from strength to strength. It's like every time they lay on, sanctions on Iran kill people. Sanctions on Venezuela kill people. Sanctions on Cuba are genocide. But as you and on Venezuela and and on Iran and these smaller countries, but Russia is the biggest grain exporter. Russia's the biggest energy exporter. They're self-sufficient, and I mean they could literally stop trade. They could stop importing anything or practically everything, and they would do just fine. They can eat. They can keep their houses warm. They can, burn, drive their cars. Russia is, like you said, this is not, the sanctions in North Korea. That's genocide. They've killed people in North Korea because of the sanctions. But Russia's different. Russia is materially wealthy in natural resources. They've only got 144 million people in a country that's 2.5 times the size of the United States or Canada or China. And so, I think the Russians are so used to being attacked. I mean, Putin said, a couple of years ago that every 50 years someone tries to invade Russia. Every 50 years, everybody wants their resources. I just heard the Prime Minister of Poland saying that we need to break up Russia into 200 individual countries, so that they can be, quote, managed better. So I think Russia's sitting in the catbird seat. It's NATO. I mean, if this is Texas poker, I would put my bets on Putin and Russia than I would on Biden and NATO, because they're the ones that have just completely they're the ones that have messed up and have just literally handed economic prosperity to Russia and the Russian people on a silver platter. It's crazy.
Recently, we've heard that Macron is saying that he's trying to talk with Russians, but there is no communication. Russians are not willing to talk with him. And the question is this: with all the all these problems that we've been witnessing during these more than 2 years of the conflict in Ukraine, who's Macron in the eyes of Russia, in your opinion? Or who's European Union? Who are these countries in the eyes of Russia? Do they really care about Europe anymore?
No, I think they've even Lavrov, the foreign minister, said a couple of 3 months ago. He said, Russia, Europe, it will be a long time before we have, deal with Europe anymore. And that's the same with the United States, that Russia is now working with India. Russia is now working with Saudi Arabia. Russia is now working with Africa. Russia's even, working with Venezuela and Cuba and Iran and China and Vietnam. Putin just went to North Korea and Vietnam, Russia is in an infinitely more prestigious and powerful position today than the Soviet Union ever was. And the Russia is a rock star, in Africa. Russia's a rock star in China. I was just in China last month. We spent a month there, and we're moving back. I'm going to retire there. The Chinese love the Russians. The Vietnamese love the Russians. I don't know about what the Iranians think, but of course the North Koreans love the Russians. So Orban of Hungary, likes Russia. Vučić in Serbia likes Russia. So whereas during the Cold War, the Soviet Union had their bloc, the capitalist West had their bloc, and they both got along, worked alongside each other. But now, Russia is much, much more active in several parts of the world than they ever were during the Cold War. So as far as Macron, I call him mini mini me Micron. He's a megalomaniac. I mean he is a certifiable megalomaniac. He was plucked out of a plucked out just like Obama who's the other one I was trying to think of? But just plucked out of nowhere, as Cornel West said, Obama was selected before he was elected. They find these people, Hitler was the same way. He was an obscure nobody, and the industrialists in the United States and Britain and Germany cultivated him and brought him up. Well, they did that with Obama, and they did it with Macron. Macron was a nobody, and he was fast-tracked into Goldman Sachs. He was made a multimillionaire overnight. He was groomed like Pygmalion, the George Bernard Shaw play, Pygmalion, where he sculpts the statue and she turns into a beautiful woman. Well, Macron is like that. He's a nobody. He's smart. He's a smart guy. But he is arrogant. He has pissed off everybody he talks to in Africa. He pisses off all the leaders he talks to in Africa. And I think a couple of years ago at the beginning, they Macron and Putin, talked on the phone. But now France is proud of the fact that they have soldiers. They sent soldiers to Ukraine. They're sending missiles and tanks to Ukraine. Now they're going to send Rafale jets, which is one of the best fighter jets in the world. Now they're going to send Rafale Dassault Rafale jets to. So now I think Russia just realizes that it's not even worth humoring the guy. He's just a he's he wants to be he wants to be General de Gaulle, Charles de Gaulle, but he's no general. He's no Charles de Gaulle. De Gaulle was a statesman and a military man, who fought in World War I and got shot two or three times. I mean, he was a real military man, a real military leader, a real president of France. He has this de Gaulle complex, and he wants to pretend like he's de Gaulle. But I don't know hardly anybody that likes the guy here. Everybody detests him. He has no he has no he's a robot. He's like an automaton. He has no feelings. He has no passion. He has no emotions. He's arrogant. He's flippant. He insults the people all the time. So that's why he will probably badly lose. They lost in the European elections on what was it, June 9th, which we voted in, and we're going to vote again on June 30th and July 7th, and we'll definitely not be voting for Macron, I can tell you that. I think the Russians think he's a joke, and they realize that Ursula von der Leyen, the EU commissioner, she's just a NATO tool. She's a NATO puppet. She's a Washington puppet. All of Europe except for Hungary and Serbia, the whole of Europe is just their vassals. They just total vassals of Washington, and you can throw Britain in as well. So I don't think Russia's going to give Europe much concern or care, for probably many years, if not decades. They're looking to India, China, ASEAN, the Southeast Asian nations. They're looking, North Korea. They're looking at Iran, BRICS. They're looking at Brazil. They don't need Europe, and they sure as heck don't need the United States.
Yeah. When you look at right now, we know that Prime Minister of India, Modi, is going to be in China, is going to be in Russia talking with Putin. And Lavrov was talking about this, and he said that they're trying to strengthen the relationship among these three countries, China, Russia, and India, and which is so important for the future of BRICS. And we have the BRICS summit on October in Russia, in Kazan. And when you look at the recent visit of Putin to China, in which at the end she was embracing Putin.
Absolutely. By the way, that's the second time, only the second time that she has actually hugged a another leader. The first time was a couple months earlier, when the Prime Minister of Vietnam. Or maybe she was visiting Vietnam, but anyway, they had a hug before they had a hug before they said goodbye. So with Putin, it was the second time, but that just tells you how important Vietnam is to China and how important Russia is to China. So Nima is India's. What a conflicted mess. It's they have millions of people who are starving to death, and people don't know this, but they have millions of people who are undernourished and who are starving to death every year. They have hundreds of millions of people with no plumbing, and they have to go to the bathroom and on the ground. There's 700 million Indians that have no toilets. So it's a country that just it, it's and yet they're launching rockets, and they have one of the biggest economies now. They've got this horrible, Hindu Muslim, conflict, not only with Jammu and Kashmir, but also within their own country. Luckily, not only is India, a part of BRICS, but India and Pakistan joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So China and Russia are working very hard to, I think, kind of, keep India, in the club. They, you know, the United States, you know, is trying to get India into this Asian quad, you know, with Australia and Japan and the United States, and that was a complete farce. And India has always been very good at playing the United States off against the Russians and the Chinese and you know, playing the triangle and I just hope that, and Modi actually got his nose bloodied in these last elections. I mean, his party did not do well. And I think he was got a little bit too full of hubris. I mean, I was reading some of his interviews, and he was very arrogant and full of himself about how important he was to India. And I think the people, you know, were a little bit tired of his, feel, acting superior and, a great leader and a great statesman. So it's a, you know, it is a quote Western, the world's largest quote Western, pluralistic democracy. It's a mess. And you can see the results. I mean, China and India, well, China was liberated in 49, and India, got its independence from nominally its independence from Britain about the same time. And the problem in India is that they replaced the white Brits in London with the comprador class that was working with the Brits, for 300 years in their colonial empire. And so the wealthy comprador, class, who were very anglicized, very westernized, took over the country. And so basically, white-skinned people and then brown-skinned people, and they're not much better. I mean, Nehru, he was maybe an exception, but every time someone mentions India, I just roll my eyes. I just don't know what to think. They refuse to cooperate with China, on the Tibetan border. They refuse. They're the ones that are causing just nonstop problems on the line of contact in Jammu and Kashmir. The problem is that for Hindu nationalists, India is shaped like a woman. If you look, is shaped like a goddess. You've got the head, the Jammu and Kashmir, and you've kind of got the two arms sticking out, and then you've got her lovely body coming down, to the tip in the south. And the Hindu nationalists believe that all of Jammu and Kashmir and all of the land between China and Tibet have to go back to the goddess of India, so that she doesn't lose, so that she's not, so that she doesn't lose her head. This is true. Did you know that? And so the so any the there's not a politician in India that can, I think, even begin to want to cooperate with China, because if they did, they would just be destroyed by these rabid Hindu nationalists that are the majority of the, well, the Hindus are the majority in the country. So it's the British Raj, left Jammu and Kashmir and Tibet in the situation that it's in today for a very good reason, because they knew, the British knew, by having these three, Pakistan and China and India, and this just it's just a nightmare. The whole geopolitical situation up there is such a nightmare. And they left a canker sore, a geopolitical canker sore for India and China, and now, and then of course Pakistan, separated from India. It's an intractable mess. I just hope that with BRICS, I just hope that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. We have to admit India has basically told the West to go to hell. They're buying all the gas and oil they can get from Russia, that they can get their hands on. So they have, if they'd have said no to, if they'd have said no to Russia and refused to buy their gas and oil and went along with the West, that would have been a big blow for Russia. So the fact that India at least did that, to against the West. Every day it's different in India. One day you're happy, one day you're mad, one day you're hopeful, one day you give up. It's a volatile country.
Yeah. When it comes to China and the conflict in Taiwan, we know that in the United States they were talking about fighting China by 2025, by 2029. Every time they're putting out a new sort of agenda. And how do you see the conflict right now in Taiwan? And if something happens between China and the United States, what would be the reaction of Russia?
That's interesting. Yeah, Russia. That would be very interesting. Although Russia and China don't have a mutual defense treaty, North Korea does, and I think this is something that no one is even thinking about in the West. If the United States pushes China into a war over using it as a proxy, just like the Ukraine, and they will do it. They will do it. But no one is considering the fact that North Korea has hyperglide missiles. They have multiple entry vehicle missiles. They can wipe out not the West Coast of the United States. They can take out New York and Washington. North Korea, they have thermonuclear weapons, hyperglide missiles. They have hundreds of thousands of God knows how many artillery shells. So if and missiles, they could take out Tokyo, they could take out Osaka, they could take out it's they're not thinking. So that if they push China into a hot conflict, North Korea will send 1.2 million Marxist-Leninist, highly, Confucianist, highly motivated, ideologically motivated soldiers across the 38th parallel, and they will overwhelm South Korea in a matter of days. I mean, what are 30,000 US soldiers stationed in South Korea going to do against 1.2 million excellent, excellent, fighters? The North Koreans are tough people, and so that no one is even talking about this, but yet they're pushing their, the United, I don't think the United States has any choice but to because they want the imperial colonial project to continue as it has continued for 500 years. They want to rape and plunder the rest of the world, and as far as I'm concerned, you can go back to the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans and the Holy Roman Empire and the Crusades and Charlemagne and all. And I mean, the Western Imperial Colonial Project for me has been going on since Alexander the Great. And but they this is the way the this is the way the Westerners think. They have lizard brains. They're just reptile brains, and all they can think about is global domination. And I think they I you know we're moving to Taiwan. Luckily, we're going to be up in the mountains. We won't be on the West Coast waving to mainland. We'll at least be up in the foothills of the mountains. I think the United States will trigger some kind of a hot conflict with China. I think that it's I don't China is not Putin. When Mao Zedong, when Mao Zedong, would warned India, Mao Zedong warned Truman and MacArthur, Don't come to our borders. Don't come to our borders. Don't, you know, he told Nehru, don't come to our borders. And when India, attacked China, they thought they were, big bad, military people, Mao cleaned their clocks. I mean, and stupidly, I think it's under, he actually gave the land back to India, and that's part of they should have kept it. But anyway, and so he, MacArthur and Truman, don't come to the Yalu River. Don't come to the Yalu River. But when China strikes, they strike with everything they've got. They don't mess around. And so they're not, this is not Putin taking village by village. China will overwhelm Taiwan in a matter of hours. And people totally underestimate China's military. They now have the biggest navy in the world. They have tens of thousands of commercial, fishermen and boats in the South China Sea that practice with the Chinese Navy for conflict situations. I just read an article that the Air Force is about ready to surpass the United States in terms of air superiority. They have hyperglide missiles. They have aircraft carrier killer missiles, thousands and thousands and thousands of them. They have Marxist, Leninist, Confucianist, highly ideological, army, who are ready to defend the motherland. 80 something, they've actually done foreigners have actually done surveys around the world saying, would you fight for your country? And over 80% of the Chinese said that they're ready to take a gun or a knife and do what they can to save their country. It was like 30 something percent for the United States and Europe. So it's they're going to do it because they have to do it, because that's their playbook is full spectrum dominance. We want to exploit, enslave, control the world. We've done it for, I think, 3,000 years, and at least going back to the 15th century with Western imperialism and colonialism. They're not going to give it up. And even and they're I think they're going to double down on I think they're going to double down on Taiwan, and it's going to be a I mean it's going to be a humiliation for the United States. I mean, China has hypersonic missiles that could take out the entire Pearl Harbor and Hawaii in a matter and Guam in a matter of minutes. They had it's just they are that powerful. They also have space. They also have their satellites, laser weapons. It's going to be bad. I don't I'm not so much worried about a world war, in Ukraine or Palestine, but I am worried about a real world war happening. Because North Korea will immediately flood across the 38th parallel. As far as Russia, they don't have a mutual defense. But here's the kicker. If North Korea goes and attack and gets involved in Taiwan, Russia has to come to North Korea's aid. And North Korea has to come to China's aid. So it's kind of like a piggyback. It's kind of so Russia will get involved, but it may not be directly with China. But if NATO wants to tangle with North Korea, be my guest, because they take no prisoners. I mean, they will die by the thousands to protect their country, and the Chinese will too. They will. Well, 35 million of them died, to liberate their country from Japan and the West and the fascist KMT Chinese. So that's to me Taiwan is mo much, much more worrisome than Ukraine and Palestine. I think that's the where the real problems may happen, because the United States, they can't ship enough weapons to Taiwan to slow down, China. Not to mention they have an 11,000 kilometer supply chain from Los Angeles and Seattle, and those ports are practically non-functioning. They're so broken down and run down. Hawaii, it's like a nightmare. But I don't think the West cares. I don't think the United States cares. I mean, the Dutch have helicopters there. The French are there. The British are there. The Italians are there. They're all there in the South China Sea, showing the Chinese how tough they are. Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we know from what we've seen in Ukraine, we know that in this war of attrition, if something similar happens in Taiwan, NATO is in no position to fight a war of attrition against China. China just each and every Taiwanese can take a shower with drones.
Taiwan is 190 kilometers off the coast of China, of mainland China. A J-17 or a J-20, a J-17 fighter jet can barely get off of the runway in Fujian across, and they're already in Taiwan before they even reach, cruising speed. It's nuts. And China's building these incredible, aircraft. They just test launched their third one, and it's the biggest non-nuclear aircraft carrier in the world. I don't know why they're even building them, because they can just sit there and launch thousands and thousands of missiles, from the mainland and hit and of course, the United States is going to drag Japan into it. The United States is going to drag the Philippines into it. The United States is going to drag Australia into it, because there's an Air Force base in Darwin that apparently has nuclear weapons. That to me, that's the scary thing, is that the United States realizes that they're full of that they are literally psychopaths, or they know that they're going to lose this thing, and they're going to pull the nuclear trigger. That's what really scares me. And Russia's not going to do it, and I don't think they're going to do it in Ukraine. But when they see what the People's Liberation Army does to and the Korean People's Army does from North Korea to South Korea. And what and the and it's going to be bad. I mean, they can launch missiles all over Japan. They can launch missiles all over the Philippines. They can launch missiles. I mean, if it came to that, China has plenty of hyperglider missiles, Mach 14 missiles to take out the Air Force base in Darwin. I mean, it's grim. And I'm just really, really worried. I'm really worried that in the as a last ditch, sort of the wounded lion, who's dying on the savannah, will lash out, and try to save itself by, pulling the nuclear trigger. That's what scares me. And then they're going to have North Korean hyperglide multiple nuclear headed missiles, raining down on Washington and New York and Los Angeles and Houston and everywhere else. So China doesn't even have to launch any. The North Koreans can do it for them. They have no idea what they're getting into, or they don't want to see it. Let's put it that way.
Just to wrap up this session, how do you find the current phase of the conflict in Gaza? Recently, Biden administration They were talking about supporting Israel if they want to fight Hezbollah. Later on, they said, no, we're not gonna help them. They're gonna be alone if they want to fight Hezbollah. And it seems that even the Biden administration is not aware of what they're thinking of at this particular moment. They don't know what they want to do. We haven't seen so far a clear policy in Gaza on the part of the Biden administration. I'm talking about the United States, not Israel. We know that what Israel wants to do in that region. How do you find it right now, the conflict?
Well, first off, I would like to everybody to be disabused of this idea that, that Israel controls the United States. The United States controls Israel. Israel is an Anglo-Saxon, an Anglo-Zionist project that was created by the British and the Americans starting in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration. It has been a British, Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-Zionist project from day one. The Israel is just another centurion army in hostile territory to control resources. And so they can say all they want. Israel is a gigantic money laundering machine, billions. I just saw an article since 1948, something like $800 or $900 billion of American money has flowed into Israel, and many of those billions, flow back to the United States, in terms of buying arms, bribing congressmen, bribing presidential candidates. It's a gigantic money laundering machine. And so is this when Biden says, oh, he's frustrated that Netanyahu is not listening to him. What a bunch of bunk. It is America. This is a NATO war. This is not an Israeli war. This is a NATO war to maintain, again, just like Taiwan, colonial control over the oil and gas in the Middle East, and that has not changed since 1917. And so, again, the frustration for people like you and me, Nima, is that for NATO, this is a huge victory, man. Look at all the arms they're selling. Look at all the contracts they're signing. Look at all the all the money being made. Look at all the donations, the millions of dollars, that Israel is pumping into campaigns, and for the presidential race. This is the perversity of the West. And clearly, you don't have to you don't even have to You don't even have to dislike Israel to see that they've lost. I mean, it is a huge, colossal failure. They have lost 800,000 people have left the country. They've all gone back to Europe and the United States. Hezbollah has created a no-go zone 30 something kilometers into northern what is Israel. It's empty. The people have left. And Hezbollah hasn't even gotten off the toilet. I mean, if they really got geared up, they could destroy Israel. And they're just like flinging rocks at Israel. And they have already removed 30 kilometers of northern Israel out of Israeli control. And Hezbollah, I mean, Hamas is not going to go away. They can total war, kill all, burn all, steal all, and rape all. The Israelis are very, very good at, slaughtering old people and women and raping people, typical, ancient Greece, ancient Russia, ancient Rome, the Holy Roman Empire, colonial Western colonialism. They're great at just, flattening and everything in sight. That's what they did in Korea and Vietnam. But they lost in Korea, they lost in Vietnam. And they're going to lose in Palestine. They cannot defeat Hamas. They could, and I've been reading that. In fact, I just saw Cy Hirst just came out with an article that a lot more people have been killed there than what they're officially claiming, 37,000 or 38,000. Because if they can't identify them, they don't count them. And so I've been reading reports that actually it's close, it's 150 to 200,000. When they finally dig up all the rubble, it'll actually, it's closer to 150 to 200,000 people that have been slaughtered there. And again, people need to understand Israel is simply the sledgehammer of NATO. They're just doing NATO's work. This is a Western project. This is a project coming out of London. This is a project coming out of Washington, and Paris is getting involved. Macron, sending, he's going to protect, protect, And so it's a disaster. I mean, it's just like the Chinese who sacrificed 35 million of their citizens to gain their liberation. The Russians lost 25 to 35 million people in World War II to defeat fascism. And let's not forget that it was Mao also defeated fascism, with the Japanese and the KMT. And you cannot defeat an idea. You can't. The West cannot understand, why they lost in Vietnam. Why did they lose in in Korea? Why? Because you cannot defeat an idea, or an ideal, a goal that you cannot defeat that kind of passion that people have. I think, to be honest with you, I think Israel's going to implode. I mean, they've lost hundreds of thousands of people. The economy is cratering. And to be as and as far as I'm concerned, Neem, it would be a blessing, because that country was illegal from day one. It never should have existed. It's an artificial state created by Britain and by the United States and by Zionists, and it is an illegal entity, and it has been a genocidal machine since 1917, and it needs to go. It needs to go. There needs to be a one state solution, and it needs to be called Palestine. That's the only. It's kind of like Russia. There, the all of Ukraine will have to end up going back to Russia for Russia to have peace and for the world to have peace. All of Israel will have to go back to Palestine. And I mean, they can all move back to Europe and the United States. I mean, 80 something percent of the Israelis are Europeans and Americans. And so, I mean, they're not Semitic. They're from Europe, and they're from the United States and Canada and Australia. They're not Semitics. They're Europeans. So that's my I it's horrible. It makes me sick to my stomach. Again, Nima, people need to understand this. The West has had thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of Palestinians in its 3,000-year history. Thousands of them. Thousands of Ukraines, thousands of Taiwans, thousands of Korean wars, thousands of Vietnam wars. This is what the West has been doing for 3,000 thousand years. It's just, total war, kill all, burn all, steal all, and rape all. I mean, that is what the West, and I hate to say it, but that's what the West has been doing for 3,000 years. So this is just another. What's nice, what's good about what's going on in Palestine is a lot of people are waking up. A lot of people are seeing what's going on. Even my daughter, who's fairly, really mainstream, in the United States in Oklahoma, she's just a school teacher, but I mean, even she's, put some things on her Instagram, that are in support of Palestine. So, it has awakened an entire generation, and it has awakened an entire, billions of people, I think, have become crucially aware of what's going on. But they don't, they, what I need to emphasize to everybody out there, it's not Israel, it's the West that's doing this. And that Israel is the proxy to destroy Palestine, just like Ukraine is the proxy to try to destroy Russia, just like Taiwan is the proxy to try to destroy, the People's Republic of China. And so this is not, this is has nothing to do with, Jews, and this is the, well, it's Judeo-Christianity, but this is a NATO project. This is a NATO war, in Palestine. It's not an Israeli war, it's a NATO war.